The Amazon is on fire, and some Brazilian cities are engulfed in smoke. It's not just the climate that suffers the effect of huge wildfires. People are feeling it too.
A kind of pain in the eyes because of the ashes and the smell of the forest burning. It was terrible.
Meanwhile, politicians and environmental activists argue about the way forward to combat climate change. I'm Marco Werman. Also today, Nathan Law. He's one of the most visible activists in the fight for Hong Kong's democracy. Even as a student here in the U.S., he's receiving death threats.
I have to stay very cautious about my daily life. But I think all these cannot deter me from participating, supporting Hong Kong democracy.
Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Thanks for being with us today. Take a nice deep breath and say thanks to the Amazon rainforest. Okay, I'm exaggerating a bit, but the Amazon region produces 20% of the oxygen in the planet's atmosphere. That's why it's been called the lungs of the earth. And right now, those lungs are burning. For the past 3 weeks, massive wildfires in Brazil have been destroying vast parts of the Amazon. Brazil's National Institute for Space Research said earlier this month that a record amount of forest has gone up in smoke this summer, more rainforest than in the last 3 years combined. Environmentalists have been especially alarmed about deforestation since the election of Brazil's president, Jair Bolsonaro, last year. He came into office promising to develop the Amazon region for farming and mining. Bolsonaro had this to say to his critics yesterday.
Regarding the Amazon fires, I'm under the impression they could have been started by the NGOs. What was their intention? To bring about problems for Brazil.
Romulo Batista is the Amazon campaigner for Greenpeace Brazil. I asked him what he sees when he steps outside in the city of Manaus.
We see here in Manaus some smoke and ashes. Fortunately, Manaus is not close of the big fires. We have some spot of fires. But in the other main capitals of the Amazon, it's almost impossible to see the light of the sun.
I mean, the Amazon is a massive rainforest. How much of it has been affected?
Well, telling right now about the area is very difficult because what we have right now is not about the hot spots. Because there is a lot of smoke, the satellite cannot read exactly the area. What we have is, this is a record in the last 9 years.
As to President Bolsonaro's claim that NGOs started the fires, what is your reaction to that?
Bolsonaro's statement is an attempt by the president to hide himself from the consequences of the anti-environmental policy he has been adopting. It's an attempt to blame anyone who denounced the environmental problems created by his own government.
How much of a factor is deforestation in causing these wildfires?
Almost all of these fires are caused by human actions. They use the fire as an instrument of deforestation. They burn the forest to destroy and occupy this area with a different use of soil. Then once we are in the dry season, it's much more difficult to control. It's important to know that the Bolsonaro government cut 50% of the money for the Previfogo, prevention of fire. He cut half of the income from this program.
Well, we've seen pictures of Sao Paulo enveloped in smoke. Do you know how this is all affecting people's health, whether it's in the Amazon or anywhere in Brazil?
In a lot of parts here in the Amazon, these are happening since this big fire season started. They have an increase of people going to the hospital because of breathing problems. In Manaus, we can smell the smoke, the smell of the forest burning. We can feel when we breathe in our eyes a kind of pain because of all this smoke and ashes in the air. This is a big problem.
Romulo Batista is the Amazon campaigner for Greenpeace Brazil, speaking with us from the center of the Amazon in Manaus. We've got until 2050. United Nations scientists say that's the world's deadline for going entirely carbon neutral if we want to prevent the worst impacts of global climate change. Many of the Democratic presidential candidates have incorporated that ambitious goal into their climate policy proposals. But today, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders went a step further. Sanders says by 2030, the U.S. should transform two sectors of its economy, transportation and electricity generation, entirely to renewables. That's just over a decade from now. So is that even possible? Dan Trag is head of Harvard University's Center for the Environment.
You know, I hate to say something is impossible, but it certainly sounds extremely challenging, especially for the transportation sector. if we just take cars, which in some ways is the easiest part, last year in the U.S., about 2% of new vehicle sales were electric vehicles. And that's almost double from the previous year. But that's still a long way from even being 100% of new vehicle sales, much less 100% of vehicles that are actually on the road. And remember that cars are just about half the problem. There's the trucks and airplanes, ships, many, many other forms of transportation that we have to think about.
What do you think can be done in 10 years?
Well, what's kind of exciting about the renewable energy world right now is that many sources of renewable energy have gotten really inexpensive. Both solar and wind costs continue to come down. And the most recent exciting news is that offshore wind has come way down in cost. And so one of the first things to do is just to build out that wind and solar on our grid. To me, that should be a no-regret strategy.
So give us a dose of realism here. I mean, what would you do to get as kind of carbon neutral as possible by 2050, the date the UN says we need to be carbon neutral?
Well, I think it's important to remember that the climate system of the Earth actually doesn't care about U.S. emissions per se. It cares about global emissions. And so our goal is not just to reduce U.S. emissions, but to reduce U.S. emissions in a way that other countries can follow, because we need the whole world to do this. So, you know, having a crash program to reduce U.S. emissions, but doing it in a way that is very expensive and looks very unattractive to the rest of the world, doesn't actually help us solve the problem. We need to think about this in terms of global leadership and doing it in a smart way. This is one of the reasons why economists like a price on carbon so much, because it doesn't pick the winners, but lets the market figure out what are the most cost-effective ways to do this. And that ends up being more attractive to other countries in the world to choose those same technologies.
Well, it's interesting because Bernie Sanders' plan includes $200 billion in a green climate fund to help other countries cut pollution. Elizabeth Warren is also calling for a kind of green Marshall Plan. What are your thoughts on international aid being part of our domestic climate plan?
Well, I think it's a wonderful idea, but the numbers are way too small. You know, if we're going to spend $16 trillion in the Sanders plan to lower U.S. emissions, spending $200 billion for all the other countries in the world seems like maybe a little out of balance in terms of what the real problem requires. But it's not the total amount of money. I think it's about how we're going to spend it. I think one of the things that we should be doing is thinking about actually providing financing the way China is doing for energy investments around the world. This doesn't necessarily have to be foreign aid. We're not giving money away, but we're providing financing and we're providing technical assistance in making sure that countries are making wise and responsible energy investments over the next 20 years.
Dan Schrag, professor of geology at Harvard and head of the university's Center for the Environment. Thank you.
Thank you.
When it comes to demanding political action on climate change, environmentalists are recruiting each other to share their most effective protest tactics. This month in France, ecological groups have been holding a joint training camp for more than 1,000 activists to teach methods of nonviolent protest, including civil disobedience. They plan specifically to target the G7 summit that starts in Biarritz, France, this weekend. BBC Paris correspondent Lucy Williamson has that story.
The mood here at this sprawling camp is really peaceful, really tranquil. The sun is boiling hot today, and there's hundreds of people in little groups eating their lunch on the grass. You can probably hear their children running around under rows of brightly coloured flags. This is a country very proud of its protest tradition, but the training camp here is designed to teach people how to make their protest count. It's a different mood inside the training hall. Several dozen people are playing the roles of police, protesters and government officials for a mock demonstration. A chance to practice key protest skills, how to block officials from getting to an event, how to engage with the police and what to do if you get arrested. The organisers say they teach a strictly non-violent approach, but is it irresponsible to offer large numbers of young people training in civil disobedience? One of the trainers here today is Leah Vavasseur.
No, I don't think so. Actually, we are at a point where what our leaders, political leaders, do is irresponsible. Not taking care of climate is irresponsible, and that's why we are taking our responsibility and we are acting for climate, and this is what is responsible to do. And this is also why we train people.
The crowd here has grown since the camp started 3 years ago. More than 1,000 people took part this month, including 19-year-old Leanne.
So I was hoping to meet people sharing the same ideas as I do, and also trying to have some training about disabilities and also environmental law.
You're a law student.
I'm a law student. I want to do environmental law.
As a law student, do you think people should be breaking the law to raise awareness about the climate?
I think you can break the law if it's legit. I think some laws are not good for us. They're too complicated and they're really against justice sometimes. It's actually a paradox.
This sprawling site was donated to the camp organisers by the local mayor. He's openly supportive of the training here, despite the fact that some of the actions being taught are illegal and some of the key activists are facing trial for stealing official portraits of President Macron. One of them is 23-year-old Felix Veve, currently facing trial for removing the pictures from three town halls in Paris.
Inacceptable, la réponse qu'a donné le gouvernement.
The group he belongs to, ANV, have so far collected 127 official portraits from across France. Expect to see them reappear at the group's protests during the G7 summit.
It feels like the government response to civil disobedience is hardening. But on the other hand, more and more people want to learn these techniques. A year and a half ago, there were 40 of us mobilizing regularly. Now there are hundreds who turn up for every action.
The tactics of both police and protesters have been under scrutiny in France after months of demonstrations by the Gilets Jaunes social movement, with the police facing accusations of unnecessary force in dealing with them. Commander Christophe Rouget, a spokesman for the French police union, explained how they were preparing for the G7 summit.
French police officers are used to managing major events, but there is a certain apprehension because we are in a particular climate with this year's demonstrations behind us, the fatigue of the police forces, and also a lot of stigma of the police from extreme left groups.
Organisers at the training camp say their strategy is non-violent and they'll adapt their methods depending on the police response. One thing we're sure of, Leah told me, we want to have our message heard. Whatever the level of police repression, we'll do something.
The BBC's Lucy Williamson in Biarritz, France. That's where world leaders from the G7 countries arrive tomorrow. Their summit starts on Saturday. Collectively, the seven countries plus the EU are the world's dominant financial powers. But they also happen to be countries under enormous political stress at the moment. Canada's Justin Trudeau faces ethics complaints. Italy's prime minister just resigned. The UK continues to struggle with Brexit. And here in the US, voters are still very much divided over the 2016 election and what could happen in 2020. One player watching closely from the sidelines is Russia. President Trump arrives in France this weekend, and he's made the case that Russia should be brought back into the G7, returning the group once again to the G8. We'll have more on that story tomorrow here on The World. Coming up next, the West African nation of Ghana is inviting the descendants of enslaved Africans to come home. It's even offering them land for resettlement. But this Ghanaian chief says there's a learning curve for African Americans moving to Ghana.
You're coming in and your expectations are that it should be like America. It can't be like America. And even if it was like America, you'd be discriminated against.
That's coming up next here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. It was 400 years ago that the first enslaved Africans were brought here to the English colonies. All this week, we've been hearing stories from Ghana, one of the places in Africa where the transatlantic slave trade began. In the final stories in our series from Ghana, the world's Rupa Shenoy introduces us to the chief of one ethnic group there who's apologized for its role in slavery.
First of all, full disclosure. When you visit some chiefs in Ghana, you're supposed to bring gifts, specifically bottles of local whiskey. We brought 3 bottles for the chief of the Kwamu ethnic group. Only 3, unfortunately.
3. Why 3 and not 4?
One of the chief's ministers explains the proper etiquette.
We don't bring 3 here. You either bring, it's in the number of 2, 2, 2, 2, 2. So it should have been 4.
We're in the chief's palace in Ghana's Volta region. It's a green mountainous area with lots of lakes about an hour away from Accra. The chief, Kwafu Okutu, arrives with his aides in traditional dress and sits in a throne at the head of the room. He reminds everyone to check their phones.
Just put them on silent.
I've been instructed not to cross my legs and to address the chief as Your Majesty. I ask him about Akwamu history.
I'll say if we want to talk about Akwamus today, I mean, we'll talk until the cows go to graze and come home.
They once ruled half this country. They were fighters and protectors, victims of the slave trade, and participants in it too. Once they took over a so-called slave castle in Accra, where the Danish lived and imprisoned Africans before selling them into slavery, the Akwamu seized the castle for leverage in order to negotiate for better terms in the slave trade.
It is a checkered history that happened, and we cannot dwell on the past forever. We've rendered our apology to our kinsmen who were taken from the coast of, especially West Africa, to the diaspora to go and serve as slaves. We jointly condemn that inhumane treatment. We cannot explain too much why it happened, but all we say is, with all due apology, they should come home and put a closure to it so that we can live as brothers and sisters again.
The chief has offered land to any African Americans who want to come live here.
You see, home is home, and no matter what happened, we think this is where they belong. They are part of us.
No one's currently taken him up on the offer. Still, he says he knows African Americans love African culture, and if they move here, they should be prepared to be part of it.
You know, America is America, the land of freedom. You know, so everybody got to do anything that you like. You can't even call your mom by her first name. You know, but in Africa, in our culture, you don't do that. You cannot call your dad by his first name. Hey, Peter, you know, you cannot do that. You know, it's not cultured.
The differences between African and American cultures, those come up a lot.
My name is Fritz Baffel.
This is another chief I spoke to. He's from another ethnic group, from an area inside Accra. And he's a little less formal. We meet at a tennis club.
You know, when African Americans come here and they want things done quick, because they feel that they've come home and therefore we should jump and welcome them. You're coming in and your expectations are that it should be like America. It can't be like America. And even if it was like America, you'd be discriminated against.
Balfour has experience with Americans. He was a member of parliament in 2015 when the Obama family visited. And Balfour escorted them through Elmina Castle, one of the hubs of the transatlantic slave trade.
When a foreign dignitary comes to any location in Ghana, the first stop is supposed to be the traditional chief's palace.
Balfour says Obama's advance team wanted to skip that part. Balfour insisted.
You know, it was to and fro, but we managed to convince the Americans. And so when President Obama came, he met the traditional ruler, and they did the proper welcoming, pour libation, and do the traditional rites that we use when a visitor comes to us.
The visit was a huge boost for Ghana, Balfour says. Obama addressed the history of slavery in a way that didn't overtly place blame.
One of the most striking things that I heard was that right above the dungeons in which male captives were kept was a church. And that reminds us that sometimes we can tolerate and stand by great evil even as we think that we're doing good.
It's not that because we remain that we have got to be guilty, all right? It's not about the blame game. It's about a conversation. But the thing is, when it comes down to the nitty-gritty, it was Europe who initiated the slave trade.
He says it's Europeans who started the slave trade and then imposed colonialism, ravaging this country and setting it back by decades. Ghanaian social media personality and editor Jamila Wumponi Abdullahi says some Ghanaians argue that they have suffered just as much as African Americans.
It becomes this narrative of the Africans or the black people in America struggling more than the black people on the continent or whatever. At the end of the day, the reality is it was an injustice to an entire group of people.
And the reality in Ghana today is that unemployment is high. Some children still work instead of going to school. In some places, women can't own land. If you have to go to a public hospital, you have to bring your own bed sheets, drinking water, and hot water flask.
I've had conversations with people who I really considered to be part of those who would help rebuild Ghana. Like, honestly, some of our brightest, most well-equipped people, and they're leaving.
Instead of asking African Americans to return, Jamila says Ghanaians should be focusing on what they can do to improve the situation here so educated Ghanaians stay in the country. She's one of the few people openly questioning Ghana's call for the African diaspora to return.
What are they moving back home to? I know the struggle of living abroad, studying abroad. I have done that multiple times. But it is not the same as trying to figure things out in an environment where the system does not work.
But at the First Chief's Palace, I did meet at least one family that's considering moving back. A mom and daughter. They were in the audience as I talked to the Kwame Chief.
Very beautiful question.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
The mother, Donna Apaku, was born in Ghana and moved to the U.S. when she was 18. After retiring from a career in nursing, she moved back here to be an advisor to the Okwamu's queen mother, the chief's mom. She wants black Americans to see Africa and Ghana the way Jewish people see Israel.
They would die for Israel. So why isn't it be done for Africa? And yes, it's slavery, but still, Africa wants them. So they should come home.
Donna's daughter, Akua Apaku, owns a tourism business in San Francisco and is thinking about moving here herself. She has four young boys.
I call them my little brown boy, Joy, and the incidents with Trayvon Martin and Tamir Rice give me pause in raising a young black man in America. We want our children to experience being in a place where they're free.
They haven't made a final decision yet, although Akua can attest that there's a lot of culture to get the hang of here.
If you get scolded for not doing the quote-unquote right thing traditionally, I implore all my brothers and sisters in diaspora, don't take it personally, because we're all getting it.
She says African Americans who come to Ghana should stand their ground, because Africa belongs to them, too. For The World, Rupa Shenoy, Accra, Ghana.
Spend some time with all of Rupa's stories from Ghana, photos, reporting, and personal reflections, all at theworld.org. You're with The World. Tomorrow, the Trump administration rolls out a new immigration policy that could keep migrant families in detention indefinitely. Critics say there is a better way.
The alternative is, it's a pejorative term, but the alternative is catch and release. It worked before.
I'm Marco Werman. Stay with us for that story here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH, PRI, and PRX. The Trump administration is set to publish new regulations tomorrow that would permit the indefinite detention of migrants, including children, who enter the country without papers. The plan would overturn a decades-old rule known as the Flores Settlement Agreement. The Flores Agreement came out of a 1997 Supreme Court ruling. It was designed to protect children from the physical and emotional harm caused by extended detention, and it limits the amount of time children can spend in detention to 20 days. The Trump administration argues that migrants are using Flores as a loophole to get into the country. Bill Ong-Hing is a professor of law at the University of San Francisco and director of the Immigration and Deportation Defense Clinic. So what do you think of this idea, this rule change?
Well, I think it exacerbates the problem because the conditions at detention centers are terrible, from health and safety to the lack of adequate medical care. And so this would just make things worse to be able to continue the detention of family units much longer than 20 days.
So removing Flores, I mean, the basic tension, of course, is the position of the White House trying to restore integrity, it says, to the immigration system, that if you enter the U.S. without papers, you will be locked up until processed. I mean, what is wrong with that?
Well, what's wrong with that is that it really ignores why people are entering the United States, why they're fleeing their home countries. And it ignores the fact that this is more of a regional crisis, and it's about people fleeing violence in all different forms. And to greet those individuals with a prison cell, that just lacks any aspect of humanitarianism.
It is understandable why migrants are fleeing their countries, the violence, I mean, to start with, and you can't really blame them for exploiting the loopholes to get into the U.S., and the Flores settlement can be seen as a giant loophole. When there is such a massive influx and backlog of migrant cases here, what is the alternative?
Well, the alternative is, it's a pejorative term, but the alternative is catch and release. It worked before. You process these individuals. They all know where they're headed. They often have relatives, friends in the United States already, and that's where they're headed. And in the past, prior to 2014, it worked. People would go to those places. They were told they had to report to deportation officers. They had to report to immigration courts. And they largely did at a more than 90% appearance rate. It works. Catch and release works. That's the more humanitarian way. So I don't view the Flores settlement as a loophole because people don't always come with their children.
So, Bill, your work is focused on protecting the Flores settlement. What can you do to protect it now?
Well, the litigators are going into court probably either tomorrow or early next week, arguing that the proposed regulation violates the stipulated agreement that was entered into 22 years ago, and the court will determine whether or not what is being proposed is consistent with what the court approved in 1997.
Do you think this plan of indefinite detention will actually ever be implemented, given all these legal hurdles it's going to face?
We don't know what will happen at the lower court or the higher courts, but if the court is going to be true to the spirit and the letter of the agreement, which is to expeditiously reunify folks with their relatives in the United States, I don't see how the regulation will stand.
Bill Hing at the University of San Francisco, thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Earlier this month, immigration agents raided multiple meat processing plants in Mississippi. Nearly 700 people were detained in one day. About 300 of them were released, but the rest remained in detention. So far, none of the employers in Mississippi have been charged for hiring undocumented workers. What does that mean for those immigrants who remain on the job? As the World's Monica Campbell reports, some workers are speaking up for themselves, but there can be consequences.
We're where Luis worked. It's a large dairy. You lived right here, and you worked steps away from the dairy.
Yo vivía atrás, en la trayecta que está ahí atrás.
And you lived there with your wife and your children?
Sí.
Luis Alberto Echeverria is from Mexico and came to the U.S. without papers when he was 15. He worked on farms for years, like this one, in Turlock, California, east of San Francisco. It's a big dairy, at least 1,000 cows. And in 2008, Echeverria was prepping a cow for milking when she kicked him right in the ribs.
El compañero que estaba trabajando conmigo en ese rato, él cuando desperté estaba echando mi aire en...
He was knocked unconscious, and when he came to, a coworker was saying, wake up. He was told to keep working despite any pain. Joe Salaberry was Echeverria's boss. He's owned dairies for years in California, and he migrated himself from France in the 1950s. Salaberry says Echeverria was lying and hadn't been injured. We spoke on the phone.
He didn't have no fractured rib.
He still didn't believe it, even after Echeverria returned from a hospital with a note saying he had a fractured rib and needed rest.
In fact, I called his doctor and I told him, he gave him 2 weeks off. And I called his doctor and I told him, what the hell's the matter with you? I told him, you give this guy 2 weeks off. He didn't even get touched by a cow. And he hung up the phone on me.
And then Luis was fired.
Should I fire him?
Echeverria sued. Esmeralda Zendejas was his lawyer.
There was documentation to support the fact that he had got injured. The injury was on the job, and immediately thereafter, he was terminated from his employment.
Echeverria also sued for unpaid overtime and alleged that there was no time to eat or rest on the job. But then his story took a turn.
Ya cuando salimos, que me subió a mi carro.
Echeverria was at a deposition. It's part of the legal process for his lawsuit. And after he left that meeting, he says he was followed by immigration agents in plain clothes. He was stopped, handcuffed, and put in a van.
No más me agarraron, pum, 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 me trasladaron rápido. Vámonos.
He said he didn't know where he was going and that only later the agents said they were with ICE. And they pointed to an old conviction for illegal gun possession. That same day, Echeverria was deported and left in Tijuana, Mexico. He believes his boss's lawyer told ICE where he'd be that day and that it was a setup. The lawyer, Anthony Raimondo, has been accused of this many times, that he cooperates with ICE about immigrants suing his clients. And Raimondo doesn't deny that.
So if law enforcement contacted me about one of my neighbors and they were suspicious that my neighbor was doing something illegal and they asked me for cooperation, I would cooperate.
Not long after he was deported, Luis Echeverria came back to California wanting to be with his family.
Y sí, crucé por ahí, tuve que pasar por un túnel de agua. Estaba largo.
He says he crossed through a long water tunnel at the border and then reconnected with his lawyer. And he was granted a special visa for crime victims. It was based on obstruction of justice, since Echeverria was deported while he was in the process of suing his former boss. I ask him, after all of this, would he sue his boss again?
Yo no quería problemas, porque aparte de eso, como ellos, los patrones se conocen entre ellos.
He says at first he didn't want any problems and worried that standing up for himself would get him blacklisted by other farmers. But he says once he started the legal fight, he didn't want to stop. He wanted to set an example for his kids. But he understands why some immigrants might be unwilling to speak up like he did, particularly with the Trump administration's anti-immigrant agenda.
No sabemos qué. ¿Qué nos puede pasar el siguiente día? Pero...
He says, we can't be sure what might happen tomorrow.
Essentially, what's happening is that their immigration status is being weaponized against them.
Jessie Hahn is a lawyer with the National Immigration Law Center. Normally, she's in D.C., but was in Mississippi when we spoke. She's assisting immigrants there after a series of raids at poultry processing plants. She says that if immigrant workers don't feel free to speak up, it doesn't just harm them. It harms all of their colleagues.
If you have this whole system set up in such a way that immigrant workers cannot speak freely about the problems because they are at risk of these types of enforcement actions or retaliation from their employer, then that doesn't only damage them, that damages the other workers who are working under the same conditions.
Just this month in New York, WNYC reported on an undocumented man from China who sued the restaurant where he worked for back wages. And while he was taking a lunch break during a deposition, ICE detained him, and he's now fighting deportation. Today, Luis Echeverria works delivering cabinets and likes the job. He's done with dairy farms, and he rents a small home and lives with his three children. They're all U.S. citizens. His son, Alberto, listens while we talk. He's 19 and works in the fields. He picks apples. And he says he worries about his dad sometimes, that he could still get deported even though he has a visa now.
I feel kind of scared for him. To be honest.
I feel scared for him.
Yes, I feel scared for him.
His dad pauses for a while and says,
La vida siempre es así. Todo el tiempo nos vamos a arriesgar.
That's life, he says. Sometimes you take risks. He also knows his story isn't an easy one. He confronted his boss, but got deported.
Tal vez para que alguien más no le suceda lo que me pasó a mí, tal vez lo estoy haciendo para eso.
But he says that maybe by sharing his story, it'll keep what happened to him from happening to others. For The World, Monica Campbell, Modesto, California.
Several big banks in Hong Kong today paid for full-page newspaper ads that basically say, enough is enough. After 2 months, they want the protest to stop. But that seems unlikely because more demonstrations are planned for later this week. Nathan Law has been at the center of Hong Kong's pro-democracy movement. 3 years ago, he was elected to the local legislature as part of a wave of progressive activism. Here he is in 2016, taking the oath at the Legislative Council.
You can chain me. You can torture me. You can even destroy this body. But you will never imprison my mind.
But a few months after that, Law's legislative career was brought to an end. A judge barred him and his colleagues from holding office for failing to read the oath properly. These days, Nathan Law is traveling back and forth from the U.S. to Hong Kong. He's enrolled at Yale University, but even there, he's been the target of death threats.
I don't know where these messages are coming from. I don't know whether they're American or Chinese or where they live. But it's very obvious that Beijing tried all sorts of online harassment and also sending threatening messages.
What kind of messages? What have you actually been reading? And what form has the online harassment taken?
Threat on my personal safety. So I've already reported to the police department, the Yale Police Department.
So that's one department of law enforcement. I mean, some of these threats, I saw them talk about killing you. How, aside from that, are you staying safe?
One thing that I am sure is I have to stay very cautious about my daily life and try to be smart and try not to get into dangerous situation. But I think all these cannot deter me from participating, supporting Hong Kong democracy.
Do you really think that Beijing's government would take some action against their opponents in the United States?
I have no guess on that. The best I can do is to stay very cautious.
The divide between the pro-democracy movement in Hong Kong and supporters of the Beijing government, it's playing out, as you know, around the world with demonstrations and counter-demonstrations in cities with large Chinese populations like Vancouver and New York City, cities across Australia. How new is this trend and how much does it worry you?
Well, with free flow of information, with major media outlets following Hong Kong protests for more than 2 months, this kind of stigmatization from Beijing doesn't seem convincing. So I think the way Beijing is acting now, encouraging people to spread false information to attack activists like me, this tactics is adopted a week or 2 weeks ago. It's not a very coherent tactics from Beijing.
Beijing also says that Washington is behind the protests in Hong Kong. How much truth is there to that, do you think?
They have been saying that protesters receiving money from the U.S., saying that activists like me are trained CIA agents, and saying that all the hostile foreign forces are pushing forward the separatism movement in Hong Kong. And I think these are all nonsense. And the global community and the international media outlets are very clear about Hong Kong people's determination and their self-initiated action.
That is a potent accusation, though, that Washington is behind the protests in Hong Kong. How can pro-democracy activists in Hong Kong counter that charge? How can you refute that? And now you've got celebrities like Jackie Chan saying stability is a good thing.
These Hong Kong people fight for themselves and no other foreign forces are behind them. So I think it's crystal clear and international media have been doing their job well in order to cover these stories. And I think to maintain stability in Hong Kong is not by brutally dispersing people and their legitimate demands, but it's to talk with them and to answer their demands and to implement democracy, a system that could resolve conflict.
Nathan Law, one of the leaders of Hong Kong's pro-democracy movement, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
Singapore takes education seriously. Its school system has been ranked as one of the best in the world. But rankings for Singaporean students will soon be a thing of the past. The government plans to put a stop to its system of ranking young children in schools. Anushka Bey is a child psychologist in Singapore, and she explains the kind of stress the system creates for kids.
Well, if you're talking about PSLE,
Basically, students take this when they are in their sixth year of formal primary education, and they get an aggregate score. Once this is achieved, it then determines what secondary school they're streamed into. So you can imagine it's very important in a culture where tests are, you know, considered a very high priority.
So what are your thoughts on Singapore schools no longer using this exam ranking system on young children?
It comes off the back of a change in sentiment, which is very much an emphasis on the joy of learning, which I can tell you wasn't prevalent when I was growing up and going to local school here, which I did for some years.
So what led to this change in Singapore?
Well, if you look at some of the statistics, there have been increasing instances of kids speaking out about stress levels. You're looking at an average of, I think the IMH reports an average of 2,400 new cases at their clinics each year. The IMH is the Institute of Mental Health in Singapore. And these are new cases of students coming in because of school-related stress. You have instances, very, very, very sad cases of, I think there was a young child in 2016, a young boy who committed suicide. He jumped from his 17th-story apartment after failing his midterm exams and being incredibly frightened to tell his parents.
And how much does that anxiety then extend to affecting the physical health of the children?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And so anxiety is twofold. What you have is an impact on the child's emotions, such as, you know, you may have children who present with depression, helplessness, fear, anger, irritability, lack of motivation. On a physiological level, though, to answer your question, because the body is essentially perceiving that there's a threat. Now, this threat can be the threat of failure and what that means. The body goes into fight or flight. So what you can experience is a racing heartbeat, sweating, sleep disruption, panic attacks, difficulty concentrating, and in the long term, adrenal fatigue. So it's very damaging, actually, on a physiological level.
So what do you want to see that suggests this move to drop exams is more than just kind of letting them off the hook?
Sure. Look, and to be clear, it's not that I don't endorse it. I do. I just feel that there is perhaps a bigger shift that's required. So I went to local school in Singapore for 10 years. I then shifted into an international school and went to America, actually, for university. And it wasn't until I went to the States that I understood this joy of learning, that at the heart, really, of why we go to school is essentially to learn. And that it's not just purely about how you're performing on a test. Now, obviously, the shift, I think, away from taking tests to evaluate students is an important thing that's happening. But that shift, I think, also has to occur in the hearts and the minds of people on a cultural level.
Anushka Baer, child psychologist in Singapore, thanks very much for your time.
No worries. It's a pleasure.
Protesters in Hong Kong are finding inspiration from another nonviolent protest movement. It took place 30 years ago. It was called the Baltic Way. Much like many Hong Kongers are feeling now, people in the Baltics in 1989 saw street demonstrations as their only option.
Choosing to participate in Baltic Way was not a big of a choice. It was as natural as wanting to be free.
Vesma Puharte was living in Latvia back then. She was 20 years old when she heard about the protests on the radio.
We found out that there will be Baltic Way, and I do not remember exactly how I found out, but I think maybe radio. And we basically got in a bus, quite a few of us, drove down towards the Lithuanian border looking for the break in a chain.
A break in the chain of people, that is. Puharte joined hands with 2 million people, forming a human chain across the borders of three Baltic countries, Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia. It stretched for almost 400 miles.
It was because of us, in a little tiny part, that the chain was not broken. Other than that, it was just the sunshine and quietness, just quiet, quiet, quiet. Nobody was singing, nobody was speaking, but it was just a rather incredible feeling, really.
People were protesting the Soviet Union's version of their history. In 1939, a secret agreement between the USSR and Nazi Germany divided Europe. That led to the Soviet occupation of the independent Baltic countries. The Soviets denied this, saying that the Baltic states had voluntarily joined the Soviet Union.
In school, you never learned about it. You never knew about it. And all of a sudden, you learn this whole entire new bit of history that was hidden from you.
The Baltic protests happened on August 23, 1989, the 50th anniversary of that Soviet-German agreement. People who took part in the Baltic Way wanted to send a message to the world. Vesna Puharte says they wanted freedom from the Soviet Union.
It was awful to see how the large powers worked together and how little the freedom of Baltics mattered. So then you kind of wanted to make sure that you are heard.
The protests turned out to be successful in the end. Gunther Schmidens is an associate professor of Baltic Studies at the University of Washington. He says the Baltic Way was crucial for the independence of Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia.
That was the turning point. The legend goes that at this moment, Gorbachev, the head of the Soviet Union, looked at the news from the Baltic and said, "We've lost them and we'll never get them back."
For Schmidhens, the Baltic Way reminds him of other pivotal nonviolent demonstrations, including the civil rights movement here in the U.S.
Seeing it happen in 1987 through 1991, for an American, was a reconfirmation of these ideals that I had grown up with as having worldwide significance, that through nonviolent political organizing, nonviolent assembly, nonviolent free speech, humans can accomplish great things.
This song is called The Baltics Are Waking Up. It's in the three Baltic languages, Lithuanian, Latvian, and Estonian. It was composed for the Baltic Way, and it's sometimes known as the joint national anthem of the Baltics. The World's Indra Ekmanis reported on the 30th anniversary of the Baltic Way. Check out her story at theworld.org. Our theme music was composed by Ned Porter. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Tomorrow's Friday. We'll see you then.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, PRI, and PRX.